It's hard to describe what Urban Dreams in Des Moines does because they do so much. This hour, we'll get to know this organization that has been making connections, overcoming barriers, and changing lives since 1985. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'll talk with Wayne Ford, founder of Urban Dreams, also a retired state representative, and Isaiah Knox, executive director of Urban Dreams. Then later in the hour, 86 years before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus the Board of Education, an African-American Iowan named Alexander Clark won the first successful school desegregation case in the history of the United States. We'll talk about the legacy of Alexander Clark and black activism in Iowa. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll talk about the legacy of a truly remarkable Iowan, Alexander Clark, a visionary and groundbreaking African-American activist and lawyer from Muscatine. But first, Urban Dreams was founded in 1985, and since then, it has been providing a wide range of human services programs in inner city Des Moines and central Iowa. They've been making connections, overcoming barriers, and changing lives for members of Iowa's underserved and underrepresented populations in so many ways that it's actually a little bit difficult to summarize. They've been helping individuals with substance abuse, mental health challenges, criminal records, reentry programs, helping young people access education and realize their dreams, providing programs for kids, and improving community relationships with the police force. Wayne Ford is the man that started it all. He's the founder of Urban Dreams and a retired state representative. He served in the legislature from 1996 to 2010. Hello, Wayne. Wayne, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Where's the mic? I see the mic right now. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Welcome to the show today.
All right. Thank you very much.
We also have with us Isaiah Knox, who is the executive director of Urban Dreams today. Hello, Isaiah.
Hello. I can't hear you. I'm having a technical difficulty.
All right. We'll get that worked out. But let me talk to you. Wayne, let's go back in time a little bit to when you founded Urban Dreams. Tell me what the spark was that started you on this path.
Wow. Long time ago. 1983, Bishop Dingman, Maurice Dingman, the Catholic Archbishop of Des Moines, he was kidnapped from the hood. He was walking down 6th Avenue. Two young black men kidnapped him, threw him in the car, and took him to Baltimore. At that time, the city was in a rage. The police, the city council members, you know, I was just a young community leader, but they came to me and asked, what's going on? They were locking black men up the street. They were locking up young kids. I mean, it was a bad time. Elaine Simoniak, the legendary Elaine Simoniak, former city council member, came to me and said, Wayne, we got a big problem going on. Can you do anything about it? You know, well, I had a degree from Drake University. I had a show on WHO radio. I was beginning my journey. And I said, I don't know. I mean, I'm working for the city of Des Moines. I'm in charge of the Model City Community Center. I just don't know if I want to get involved. She was saying, Wayne, we got to get you involved because we need you at a critical time in this junction. So Bishop Dingman did not lose his life. The young black kids brought him back. And I remember this kind of scenario more personal because when Bishop Dingman used to walk up and down 6th Avenue, 6th Avenue at that time was rated the most violent neighborhood in the state of Iowa. You had prostitution, open drive-by shootings. I mean, it was just a crazy time. You had nightclubs. Anybody who knows about 6th Avenue back here in the 80s know what I'm talking about in the 70s. So he used to walk up and down the street, and I never forget this classic scene. I say, Bishop, the neighborhood is changing. He said, Wayne, don't worry about it. I got a good relationship to God. And he looked up to the sky. I never forget that scenario. So he got kidnapped. Elaine Simoniak said, Wayne, I'm going to try to get you $10,000 to get Urban Dreams started so you can go out there and do what you do. And, you know, I'm originally from Washington, D.C. A lot of people were well aware of my resume. Did a lot of bad things when I was young, turned my life around. Went to school to Rochester, Minnesota. I was only black on the football team. Got a football scholarship to Drake University. And as they say, the rest is history. So that's how I started. I started on when Bishop Dingman got kidnapped and Elaine Simoniak, City of Des Moines council member, got me a $10,000 grant. And as they say, the rest is history.
Well, all right. $10,000 to start with, to start something with this big a vision, maybe isn't that much. What was your original vision for this organization?
Good point. Well, you know, me and Gars had a good relationship. Back in the eighth grade, I was told to write my obituary. I mean, people, I'm from the hood in Washington, D.C. People die all the time. And even back in the 50s and 60s, the teachers would come in there and say, somebody died, so can I have your lunch money so we can help bury the person? But this teacher did something unique. She said, today I want everybody to write their obituary. Now, this is in the hood in the inner city of Washington, D.C., back in the early 60s. So I never forget this. God took my hand, and he told me to write this down. I'll be in the Midwest. I'll be in charge of community center. I'll be involved with politics, and upon my death, they would name something after me. Well, so I had a vision. So when that thing happened with Elaine and all the things happened, it was just for me fulfilling a God vision that I had for my obituary that I'll be in the Midwest. I'll be involved with politics. As you know, I was Representative Wayne Ford. I'll be involved with a community organization, which is Urban Dreams. So I guess it was the vision, the spiritual vision that God gave me. So it wasn't about the money. I knew I could raise money, but it was about the vision, everything falling into place, and I was at the right place at the right time.
Well, let's talk about some of the early programs that you developed at Urban Dreams. As I said, it's hard to summarize all the many things that you've done at Urban Dreams, but one of your first ideas was that you needed to help develop the relationship between the police force and the people in your community, right?
Yes, indeed. Well, to today, my best friend in Washington, D.C. is a former Washington, D.C. police officer. I want to say it again publicly. My best friend. For all these years I've been gone from Washington, D.C., is a former retired Washington, D.C. police officer. So I know that I had no idea about the future and the conflict between the community and blacks and whites and all that. I got all that. But my best friend today is still a police officer. The bottom line is this. I knew when I'm in the hood, coming from where I come from, you got to have a good relationship with the police department. You got to remember, we had drive-by shootings here in the 80s. Gangs were coming in. You know, I went to the first funeral of the drive-by shooting. It was about, hey, y'all, we got to work this together. So I've known all the police chiefs from Wendell Nichols all the way up to the current police chief. So I have known all the police chiefs, and I've always thought something. You know what? If somebody do something to me, the first thing I'm going to do is call somebody. The first person I'm going to call, if you hurt me, I'm going to call the police. So we talk all that stuff. But I don't know anybody who's going to be in a bad situation. I don't care who you are. And the first time somebody do something to you, you're going to call the police. So that is my philosophy. I recognize I wanted to get them in. And Chief Mulder, I never forget this. He was the first organization that I had down at Urban Dreams in 1985. It was called Social Services Decentralization and back into a target area. I wanted to bring nonprofits. I wanted them to bring everybody back into the hood. But here's a critical point. I wanted them to be open past 5 o'clock. Because that's when all the shootings and all the gun and all the drug dealings, all that happens, I mean, at nighttime. So the first organization I had in my building in 1985 was the Des Moines Police Department. I thank former Chief Bill Mulder for making that happen.
I'm going to bring Isaiah into the conversation because Isaiah, of course, now is the director of Urban Dreams. And I know the two of you developed a relationship before Isaiah Knox became the executive director. Isaiah, how did you get involved in this organization?
Yeah, that's a good story. So back in 2002, when I just graduated from Drake University, I was walking home from Centro to my house over by Drake, and someone had got shot at Oak Ridge. So not being from Des Moines, only being here for 2 years, I saw Wayne Ford on TV and Urban Dreams on TV talking about the violence that was occurring in the community, and they were there to make a difference and help. So I called Wayne the next day, and he actually hung the phone up on me. And
Don't tell her everything. All right. Look at you now. I'll leave that alone.
So I got my resume together and my shiny new degree from Drake, and went down there and knocked on the door, and he was in his office and said, are you the one I just hung up on? And sure enough, 2 hours later, I came out with the job.
Wow. So yeah. What drew you to Urban Dreams, Isaiah?
You know, that they were really doing work in the community. They were really there to make a difference. And that was something that, you know, and going to places and helping people that weren't typically helped. So that was really what drew me, was the mission and the vision, and then, of course, Wayne's leadership.
Well, let's talk about some of the many programs that Urban Dreams is involved with. I mentioned the police and community relations, which is a big part of what you do. Is there anything that you want to add to that? I know you've had some really innovative programs over the years, some really fun programs over the years as well.
Absolutely. We do a lot of fun things. So one of the things when after this transition occurred, I told Wayne, I said, there's a couple things I want to make my own during the transition. While you're still here as the executive director, because it was a 3-year process for me to take over as executive director. But we started these community events. And once a month, if not more, we do a community event that's really high quality, that's usually free or very low cost, and just bring people together. Because we know that with the transient community, people of, you know, low-income areas, there's a lot of not quality things for them to do. So we wanted to make sure that we had some quality events for them. Just this Saturday, we had the daughter dance for, you know, anybody could bring a little girl in the community to the event. You could be a grandma, a dad, an aunt, an uncle, whatever, just somebody that cares about the little kids in the community to come out. And we just had a great time this Saturday. But we do a variety of events. It's not all for kids. It's not all for adults. It's for people with cars. It's for people with that need health checkups in the community. And a lot of this stuff was happening before when Wayne was there. We just made it every single month we do something in the community.
So that's a really big part of what you do. Do you consider that to be one of your primary missions?
Yeah, well, we have 4 buckets of work. We have a substance abuse program. Also, we're a full-service outpatient substance abuse treatment center, which includes the OWI jail diversion classes across the state of Iowa. So that's one of our buckets. We have a mental health counselor on staff as well. So we do an LISW that's there that does family and adult counseling. We do workforce and education, and then we do our community events. Yes, so the 4 buckets of work.
All right. And I want to dig into the substance abuse programs. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to have time to dig in too far before our break, but we'll talk more about them after the fact. Why is that such an important part of your work?
Well, we believe that if we want people to get healthy, they need to be free from substances, right? And understand that those kind of things are really hurting their progress in life, right? It makes them make poor decisions in life. And there's too many jobs out there that you have to, when you go there, to do a UA and test for a clean UA before you can even get the job. So if we're going to get people employed in the community, we need to make sure that they're free of substances and living a good life.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes to talk more about Urban Dreams. It's an organization that was founded in 1985, and ever since then, they've been providing a wide range of human services programs in inner city Des Moines and central Iowa. We're going to talk about their substance abuse programs, their work with people who are re-entering society after being in jail or prison. We'll talk about their work with homelessness. We'll talk about their programs for kids, healthcare, getting out the vote events, jobs and education, all kinds of things that they are involved in. The organization was founded by Wayne Ford. He is a retired state representative. He served in the legislature from 1996 to 2010. And Isaiah Knox is also here with us. He is executive director of Urban Dreams today. And then later in the hour, we'll talk about the legacy of Alexander Clark and also Black activism through history in the state of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up a little later this hour, we'll talk about the legacy and vision of Alexander Clark, a groundbreaking African-American activist from Muscatine, also later on a lawyer. But right now, we're talking about Urban Dreams, an organization that was founded in 1985 in Des Moines. And ever since then, they've been working hard to provide a wide range of human services programs for inner city Des Moines and central Iowa. Wayne Ford is the founder. He founded Urban Dreams, and he's also a retired state representative. He served in the legislature from 1996 to 2010. And with us also, Isaiah Knox, who is the executive director of Urban Dreams today. He took over from Wayne Ford. And we were just talking before the break about your work with substance abuse abuse in the community. And you mentioned those four buckets of work. It sounds like substance abuse and mental health support, that's another one of the really main focuses. And tell me a little bit more about what you've been able to do with that, because that's part of helping individuals who have been struggling with the law and homelessness and all kinds of things. Tell me more about your programs, Isaiah.
Yeah, it's a vicious cycle. And we're just trying to get people back on solid footing. We do deal with a lot of people that are reentering, that have drug charges, that have to go through these processes and procedures. But here's the thing that really distinguishes us from other organizations that kind of do this work, is that, and Wayne actually started this philosophy, and this is kind of the quote from what he would used to say, we treat the dope addict just like we treat the governor when they walk into our building. So we treat people with dignity and respect. We also have counselors and people on staff that have, including myself and Wayne, as you said, mentioned earlier, that have this kind of lived experience and understand how this transition works through life. And if you want to get yourself to a certain point, there's certain things that you can no longer do. And typically, using drugs and alcohol are one of those, or definitely illegal drugs, is one of those things that you're going to have to kick if you want to go ahead and make a different kind of life. If you want to be a good parent, if you want to have a good steady job, if you just want to be a good contributing member of this society. So we really focus on those things. And like I said, we put people in place that have lived through those same experiences and then treat people with dignity and respect when they come in.
Well, and substance abuse is a barrier. Well, and mental health problems are also a barrier for so many individuals. It can be something that keeps someone living in poverty. It can create problems with families staying together or difficult situations for children. It can also lead to homelessness. So many mm-hmm. individuals who are homeless or deal with homelessness are also dealing with substance abuse at the same time, right?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things we find out is that a lot of people are self-medicating with substances instead of getting the mental health care that they need. And there's a big stigma around that, especially in the Black community and with people of low income.
Let's talk about your programs for kids, which is another big part of what you do. And again, so many different kinds of opportunities to bring kids into the center and to deal with, you know, help them out in the community. Tell me about some of your initiatives.
We're all about the kids. In January, we had a scholarship basketball game where we raised money. We had North High School play De La Salle out of Minneapolis, which was a great game. But all the tickets, money for that went to raising scholarships for students to get that post-secondary education that's so crucial. We have after-school programming that's really focused in STEM, where we got a great grant from Polk County to really update all of our technology in the building and have laptops and iPads and all kind of technology stuff for students to come in and work on that. We have IT professionals from around the state come in and around the city and the state to come in and teach that kind of stuff. All kind of stuff.
And I mean, focusing on workforce development, I mean, you're helping young people get into the workforce, but you're also helping older people get back into the workforce or help them climb up the ladder. Is that all part of the same project?
It's all part of the same kind of project, yeah, and the same bucket of work. You know, our partnership with Brawl Lawns, where we have students, or adults and young people, go in there and train and become CNAs and then get hired on at Brawl Lawns. We have partnerships with Wellmark Blue Cross Blue Shield, where we have high school students go there and intern from North High School for an entire year. Then they're eligible for full-time employment after they have that year of experience and they graduate from high school, where the median household income in our area is about $28,000, and they can go there and make a job starting at about $32,000. So you're talking about really changing the dynamics of families and that cycle of poverty.
And a lot of times people ask me about the transition between me and Isaiah. And I think that's a critical point because I served the director of Urban Dreams for 32 years. And Isaiah took over, and he's right. We had a 3-year succession plan. And I did some research. There's not no comfortable, nice succession plan. There's very few successful succession plans because things happen. Because I'm leaving, you got a young gun coming in, got the old gun going out. Ain't nothing easy. Me and Isaiah probably did that as an example better than anybody in the country. And we was told, and especially from a Black communities don't have succession plans. When the leader dies, the dream is dead, the beat goes on, you go to the gravesite and say, good job. Well, me and Isaiah did something a little bit different. I didn't take this to the grave with me, which I easily could have. I'm 67. I could have stayed until I died, to be candid. But I recognize that it's a different time. When I used to go to work at Urban Dreams, I carried a pistol. I had did things. I was there the rest of my life. Although it was a different time back then, you couldn't be in that neighborhood if you wasn't willing to protect yourself at any cost. That was a long time ago. When I chose my successor, because I chose Isaiah. He didn't choose me. I chose him. But I wanted somebody to be different. I want somebody to be social conscious, and all these computers, all these things that he knows pretty well. So it's a also we're teaching everybody. Yes, you can see. Yes, you can have a succession plan. Yes, you can have your dream continue forever. So I think it's a critical point.
Absolutely.
That I want to make you aware that I chose Isaiah because he was much different than me. Did that bring up some conflict between me and him? Yes, it did. I could write a book about it. Matter of fact, I will write a book about it.
Good.
Be candid with you. But on the other side, Urban Dreams, every time I drive down the street, every time I drive by my old building, I start crying because I've always had a dream that once I move on, with that building still, with the lights still be on? Well, the lights are still on. Isaiah got it doing it his way, and I just want to let the record show that we're doing it in a different way, but the basic common denominator is we treat everybody who walks in there just like we would treat the governor.
Wayne, with all of the good work that you've done over these decades, and you've clearly made so much progress, and I know other organizations in Des Moines have also been a part of that as well, what frustrates you the most today?
Well, I'll be candid with you. The same problem that I had. Bottom line is, when you don't have that many resources in the community, you got to remember, I grew up in an all-black city, Washington, D.C., so the dynamics of the black community coming together there were much different than the black community coming here. I was the fifth whitest community in the country. Your black population, Des Moines, around 15 to 20,000. That's not a lot of people. I had that in two blocks of Washington, D.C. So the frustration I've had was, I wish the black community that can work and network together. I had problems when I was younger. It was me coming up, and the old guns didn't want to help me. And I said, "You ain't my mother. My mother lives in North Carolina." We went through all that insecurity because we was fighting for the same dollar. That said, that still frustrates me now because I can see a little bit happening during that Isaiah's legacy and his term. And I told him some of the challenges that he'll be going through. But the black community, this is a great community. Iowa was rated, Waterloo was rated one of the worst cities in America for blacks to live in. Des Moines was in that some years ago. Okay, I got the negative side. But on the other side, you got accessibility. We got one of the very few communities that you can go and assess a CEO. You can go to United Way. You can go to the city council. You can go to the school board. Accessibility is a critical point in this community, whether you're black, white, homosexual, whoever. Accessibility. Those who have power can network with those who don't. I just wish we could do that a little bit more and recognize that it's a critical point of our growth here in this city.
Absolutely. And before I let you gentlemen go, Wayne, I know that you have another appointment that you need to get to. I know you have a great event coming up in March, on March 24th. It's one of your biggest events of the year, a whole lot of fun for everybody. It's the Cops and Kids 3-on-3 basketball tournament. Isaiah, you want to tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think it's March 30th.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay. And March 30th, we partnered with Handel University. Last year, we had 7 different law enforcement agencies participate in an all-day event where they actually played against the kids for the championship. They had a 3-on-3 basketball team. And then during the day, though, they ref the teams. They're court monitors for the teams. Just a good time to interact. That's one of one of the missions is to create positive out-of-car experiences for police officers to interact with the community that they serve, because we've had too little of that over the past years, which has created kind of this divide and negative aspect between both of the communities.
And looking at the Urban Dreams website, it looks like there are lots of opportunities for people to get involved. What are your greatest needs right now?
I mean, we always like donations, right? We are a nonprofit, so we are a 501c3, so it's a tax exempt. Donations are always good, but we always love volunteers too. We love people to come out and give us their expertise or help us out with just being there. I mean, we give away probably, I don't even know how many pounds of food every single day, which is one of the things that we just kind of fell upon with a need in the community. And Sam's Club, Walmart, Come and Go, and Quick Trip just started to deliver food to us every day. And we have 50 or 60 people just come by for our sandwiches and a donut. And then we start to get them this other services they need. But smiling faces at the organization, people that want to come in and help in any way they can. That's what we always are looking for.
Well, Isaiah Knox, thank you so much for talking with me.
No problem. Thank you.
And I think I heard Wayne leave already, so please pass along my thanks to him. Isaiah Knox is the executive director of Urban Dreams in Des Moines. Wayne Ford is the founder of Urban Dreams, the former executive director and retired state representative. Urban Dreams was founded back in 1985. And again, the correct date for that Cops and Kids 3-on-3 basketball tournament, it's coming up on March 30th. It's going to be a really fun event. But thank you so much for being here today. And now we're going to shift the conversation to go back in time. 86 years before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus the Board of Education, an African-American man named Alexander Clark tried to enroll his daughter at Muscatine's Second Ward Common School. He was denied, and he took the district to court. It was the first successful school desegregation case in the history of the United States, and really only a small part of Alexander Clark's remarkable story. Today is the 193rd anniversary of his birth. In fact, Muscatine, his hometown, is celebrating Alexander Clark Day with a number of events and celebrations. And we're going to talk about the impact and legacy of this incredible man. There's a lecture this evening. It's called The Legacy of Alexander Clark and Black Activism in Iowa, this evening at Muscatine Community College at 7 p.m. Dwayne Coleman is giving that lecture. He is pursuing his Ph.D. in history at the University of Iowa, and he is here with me now. Dwayne, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me a little bit more about Alexander Clark. I mentioned this case. This is sometimes the only story that people know about Alexander Clark, but his early history is equally fascinating. Just give me a thumbnail sketch of who he was and how he got to Iowa.
Yeah, he was really an amazing figure. I would argue that he is probably the most amazing figure in Iowa history during the 19th century, black or white. And that's for a number of different reasons. He had a long list of accomplishments in his 65 years that he lived. In coming to Iowa, he was an activist almost immediately. He came at a very young age. He was still in his teens.
Wow.
When he arrived. And we start to really notice him being an activist in the Muscatine community around 1855, there was a move by the black community of Muscatine to try to get rid of the 1851 exclusionary laws. There was an exclusionary act that was passed by the state of Iowa to exclude black people from entering into the state. And so Alexander Clark helped to organize the the black community of Muscatine to petition the state government to repeal this act that
only
was passed.
4 years after it was passed.
Yes, this was a continuing process, and even after 1855, they continued to try to get that exclusionary law and also other laws that excluded African Americans from certain civil rights, citizenship rights. As well. So he started from a very early age.
Wow. And it's so remarkable even to think about him taking on that role as activist. He was trained as a barber a very young man, and that's what he practiced in Muscatine, right?
Right. He was trained by his uncle as a barber in Cincinnati. He actually left Cincinnati in 1841. And I think one of the reasons why he left Cincinnati in that same year, a month before he left, there was a riot, a race riot that took place there, a race rebellion, in which the white citizens of the white citizens of Cincinnati tried to expel the black citizens from the city, using an exclusionary law as well. Ohio had passed exclusionary laws, and so in moving to Iowa and facing the prospect of being forced out of Iowa as a result of these kinds of laws, you can see kind of the connection as to why he, became an activist.
Yeah. What was the black community like in Iowa in the 1850s?
It was rather small. I mean, it still is rather small today, but it was very small during the 1850s and 1840s. African Americans have been in the state of Iowa since the territorial days. So African Americans have always made Iowa their home ever since, other people, other Americans have been inhabiting Iowa as well. And so it was very small, but it was very closely. It was a very close-knit community because the people had to work together. And Alexander Clark was influential in helping to create those connections, those community connections.
Well, in Muscatine, I mean, it's right on the Mississippi River. I can imagine that there was a more flow of individuals coming from different parts of the country through Muscatine and the other river towns. So there must have been an exchange of ideas and people coming and going there.
Definitely. It was a hot spot, a hub for many different peoples coming through. And I think that's why Alexander Clark was drawn to it. I think that it was an up-and-coming city. I look at it very similar to the frontier city of Cincinnati. So I think that that's what drew him to Muscatine. And as a result of his ingenuity, he was able to become a very successful businessman and wealthy in the state in Muscatine.
Interesting. And obviously became influential all around the country as well. We're going to talk about some of his relationships with other activists and other very important individuals throughout the United States during that time. We are going to take a short break. We're celebrating today the legacy of Alexander Clark. This is the anniversary, the 193rd anniversary of his birth. It's Alexander Clark Day in Muscatine, and Muscatine is celebrating with a number of events, and one of them is a lecture tonight at Muscatine Community College at 7 p.m. It's called The Legacy of Alexander Clark and Black Activism in Iowa. Dwayne Coleman is giving that lecture. He's also here with me right now. He's pursuing his PhD in history at the University of Iowa, and we will talk more about Alexander Clark, his legacy, and African-American activism in Iowa in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about Alexander Clark right now, a remarkable Iowan who 86 years before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus the Board of Education, he tried to enroll his daughter in Muscatine's Second Ward Common School. When he was denied, he took the district to court, and it was the first successful school desegregation case in the history of the United States. That's just a small part of what he did. Today is the 193rd anniversary of his birth. And with me right now is Dwayne Coleman, who's pursuing his PhD in history at the University of Iowa. He'll be giving a lecture this evening at Muscatine Community College at 7 p.m. called The Legacy of Alexander Clark and Black Activism in Iowa. And Dwayne, for the break, we were talking about Alexander Clark coming to Iowa from Cincinnati. He became was a barber when he came, built a business, became a successful businessman. But even from very early years, was involved in trying to make things better for African-American people in the state of Iowa. I want to talk about what are called the colored conventions in Iowa. And this is something that's the focus of your research right now. But tell me about these gatherings.
Right. So the colored conventions movement was a movement that began as a result of the 1829 Cincinnati race riot. The first colored convention was held in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, in 1830. And the point of that movement was to discuss the issues that black communities faced. One of the main questions that many of these early conventions posed was whether or not they should even remain in the country.
Like, should we flee and go to Canada?
Right. And so, after the 1829 race riot, for instance, in Cincinnati, there were over 2,000 black residents who left Cincinnati, some of them for Canada. And so this movement became a national movement. And there were national conventions that were held. There were state conventions that were held. There were local conventions. And Iowa had a number of these conventions, held a number of these conventions as well, state conventions. And Alexander Clark was influential in organizing and carrying out these colored conventions in the state of Iowa. And so Iowa, black Iowans ask the same questions. They ask the same questions about education rights, about citizenship rights here in the state of Iowa. And the question was even posed as to whether or not they should remain in Iowa, whether it was even possible for them to receive equal citizenship rights in the state of Iowa. And continually, the answer was a resounding, we will stay. This is our home. So the color conventions were very important to the fight for equal rights in the state of Iowa for black Americans.
The first of the colored conventions that took place, at least that we have record of in Iowa, was in 1857?
Right. Yeah, so in 1857, so this is 2 years after the petition that Clark and 32 other Muscatine Iowans signed petitioning for the repeal of the Exclusionary Act. And so the 1857 conference was to try to influence the Constitutional Convention that was taking place in Iowa during that time period to try to get certain black laws taken out of the state constitution. The word white removed from the state constitution, which then would allow black people certain citizenship rights, like right to sit on a jury, testify against a white person, education rights. So because of the word white used in the Constitution, it excluded black people from many of those rights.
I'm afraid I don't know my history that well. How long did it take for them to be successful in that effort?
Well, there were the progress was slow, and it happened over decades. It wasn't until the 1880s that all of the the laws that excluded blacks from certain rights was actually removed from the state constitution. But over time, the Exclusionary Act, for example, was overturned in 1863 during the Civil War. And I think a lot of the reason for that was because of the activism of Alexander Clark, who continued to push for it, the communities that continued to push for to remove these laws, but also because of the black soldiers during the Civil War
who were fighting with the North in the Iowa Regiment.
Right. So Iowa created an all-black regiment during the Civil War. There were over 1,000 men who served in this regiment, and Alexander Clark was instrumental in recruiting members for that regiment. He was even known to have given away his the money he received for recruiting, which was about $2, which would have been and he did this for at least 50 men. He gave back that money, that $2, which would have been a substantial sum of money during that time period. This and the reason being is because he felt that by pushing forward and getting black men the right to be soldiers, to have this regiment, would then allow them to claim citizenship rights. So this was part of a bigger move to claim citizenship rights for black people in the state of Iowa.
I think so often when we talk about these moments in history, we tend to simplify the narrative. And you're just reinforcing that there was a community, there was a vision, there was a plan, and they worked and worked and worked to move that agenda forward.
Right. Alexander Clark is little known still, but he's one of the more well-known individuals in black history here in Iowa. But there were many, many other people who were actively involved. Men and women, and oftentimes the women especially get overlooked in the story too. But his wife, Catherine Clark, was right there too. She was fighting right alongside Alexander Clark, Susan Clark, his daughter. Both of his daughters, Rebecca and Susan. In fact, the petition in 1855 has Rebecca's name on it. What's interesting about that is she was only a year old at the time. So
let's talk about the school desegregation case, because again, I mean, this is, if you know a story about Alexander Clark, this is the story that you know. And even this story, we simplify, because this wasn't just one man fighting for his daughter's right to get educated. Tell me more about what was going on that led up to this case.
Right. So this was, again, a community movement among the black community there in Muscatine to try to integrate the schools in Muscatine. And so the black school that they had in Muscatine was actually held in the AME church there in Muscatine. And the black community actually decided to one of the reasonings being as to why the there was no need to integrate the schools was because their black students could go to a black school. And so they decided that they were no longer going to have the black school anymore, so that they could make the argument that that the schools needed to be integrated. And so this was a community push. And Alexander Clark, yes, he took the lead, as he often did. But I think what's interesting about that, too, is his daughter, Susan Clark, was put at the head of this. So during a time period in which women, especially young girls, and their education wasn't necessarily
not a priority.
Priority, exactly. Right. Here is Alexander Clark and his daughter, right, and the community rallying behind Susan Clark in this push to try to integrate schools in Iowa. I think it's very profound and fascinating. And she later, of course, in the case, they won. They went to the Supreme Court after the Muscatine School Board appealed the ruling, which was in Clark's favor. I went to the Supreme Court, and they found that they found in favor of the Clarks.
It's interesting to me. Again, this was still 86 years before Brown versus the Board of Education, which is a really long time. Right. What were the ripple effects of this? I mean, did it substantially change life, at least for African Americans in Iowa?
It did. And at the same time, too, there were other attempts to try to integrate schools in Iowa even before the Clark case came about. In fact, after the Civil War, directly after the Civil War, after men of the 60th U.S. Colored Infantry, who were the Iowa Regiment, after they came home, there was an account that I've found in my research. Of two of those men who later settled in Newton, and immediately upon returning home, they enrolled in the local school there. This is in 1865, and there was some, of course, some anger from some of the white parents about their children going to school with these black men. But in using their military service, the political capital of their military service, in claiming the rights of citizenship, and also because of who they were and how they held themselves too, the community rallied around them and allowed them to continue to integrate these schools. So that case there, coupled with the Susan Clark case as well, helped to push forward desegregation of schools and desegregation of other facilities too for black people. But it was a constant thing. It was something that each community had to work at. But as a result, education became a very important part of life for African Americans in Iowa. In Newton, for example, these men, they and their wives and their children. Helped to create an environment in which education was very valued. In fact, in the 1890s, there was an article in the Iowa Bystander, which was a black-owned newspaper, that said that it was the fashion for black Newton students to graduate from high school.
That's a great fashion.
And yeah, and it said as well that there were more black students who graduated per capita in Newton than even in Des Moines.
Interesting. I want to talk about Alexander Clark and others and the fight for the right to vote in Iowa, because, again, this was going on about the same time as well.
Right. And so, the 60th became very important. Right after the 60th were discharged in Davenport, Iowa, they held a convention, Alexander Clark, so a colored convention. And Alexander Clark was influential in organizing this convention. He was honored with the position of sergeant major. He himself didn't get to serve because of an injury he had to his ankle. But this convention that they held in Davenport was to demand the rights of citizenship for black men in Iowa. And so soldiering became a very important factor in claims that they made to citizenship rights. But it wasn't until 1868 that there was a vote that eventually gave black people the right to vote here in Iowa.
We talk about the pursuit of education, and Alexander Clark himself continued to pursue education. Now, first, his son, Alexander Jr., was the first African-American to graduate from University of Iowa Law School. And then Alexander Clark himself became the second graduate in 1884.
Right. Yeah. So, again, education was very important to African-Americans in Iowa. There was a law that actually forbade black people from becoming lawyers. And so a few years before Alexander Clark Jr. actually entered the university or the law school at Iowa, that law was eventually struck down or eventually changed. And so because of that, it allowed him to be able to become a lawyer. So in 1879, he was the first black graduate from the college.
Your research focus is on these black conventions, these colored conventions that took place. Also, you're researching that African-American community in Newton. Are you finding that there's a lot of this history that is yet to be uncovered?
Oh, there's so much more that has to be uncovered. It's very unfortunate. Because it's such a rich history. And it's not even that there aren't very many records. It's just that the records exist. It just takes some effort to look for those records.
And it's been overlooked for a long time.
And it has. It has. Just recently, just this weekend, I found I'm part of a project known as the Iowa Colored Conventions Project, which is part of a national project called the Color Conventions Project. And you can find this project on colorconventions.org. And the project actually we're trying to create a digital project that will that can be used in schools to look at these colored conventions and the contributions of the colored conventions and the individuals, both men and women, who participated in the colored conventions. And just recently, just this week, past week, we discovered two new colored conventions.
Wow.
and possibly other some more as well.
Well, we will definitely have you back to talk about your research about colored conventions. But here on Alexander Clark's birthday, what do you want people to know? We only have about 30 seconds left, but why should people know his name, and what do you want people to remember about him?
Right. We just really kind of scratched the surface in terms of Alexander Clark. He also was the editor of the Chicago Conservator, which was an important black newspaper for the region. That newspaper later would be owned by Ida B. Wells. He was nominated to be ambassador twice. He turned down the first one to go to Haiti, and he accepted the second one to go to Liberia, where he actually died. But Alexander Clark, his legacy is a legacy of the black community of Iowa.
Well, we will talk more. And thank you so much for being here. Dwayne Coleman, he'll be speaking tonight at Muscatine Community College at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.